Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law, and also Greg Glazer is on the line with us today from California, a constitutional lawyer. Today is October 13th, 2011. We have so many things happening in the world of vaccinations in the United States and at what's the direction of our rights and freedoms. We're going to be talking about that and specific laws that have already been in place and how they're interpreted. In the meantime, I'd also like to inform the listeners that we are slowly transitioning as we build the Blog Talk Radio stations, the channels, and the different shows that are increasing on this coming, right after this show is actually going to be a Pet Health with Dr. Christina Chambreau talking about how to keep your pets free from fleas and your home infested from fleas. That's going to be interesting. And then on Sunday evening, we have a meditation for your health. On Monday, coming up on at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, we have a brand new show with Grant Bentley talking about homeopathy and facial analysis. It's going to be really educational. On Wednesdays, you just missed the last show with Dr. Atul Chimthalawala Kasim from India, who's a cardiologist, talking about hypertension. And we're going to be continuing every week about heart health and specifically hypertension series right now. That is Wednesday at noon. So you can see we're building up the shows, and therefore, Alan, he's going to really be in charge of the vaccination shows on Thursday. I want to also tell you that Alan has a fabulous ebook, and we're going to give you some more details about that at the end of the show. But if you are concerned about vaccinations, your right to an exemption or a waiver, this is the baseline, the foundation information that you're going to need to determine whether you need to get some professional advice. So, Alan, go ahead and introduce our guests and what the subject is today.
Thank you, Debbie, and congratulations on the terrific work you're doing expanding your work with homeopathy and all the different shows you're doing. This is just amazing, and it is exciting to watch what you're doing and what's going on, and, of course, to be a part of it every week here with the Vaccine Rights Show. Today, and normally the first Thursday of the month, occasionally we reschedule as we had to do this month, but very glad to have attorney Greg Glazer back with us, and I am really excited about today's topic. It's one of those wish I had had time to research this myself kind of things that never got around to, and so I am looking forward to learning a lot today. Greg's, as Debbie mentioned, is an attorney from California, specializes in constitutional law, and Greg, probably some other areas of, as well. You want to mention briefly what your practice and work entails?
Sure, thanks, and it's nice to be here. My practice areas include contracts and estate planning and real estate, in addition to constitutional law.
And you're in what part of California?
I'm in the Bay Area.
Okay, so folks in that area with issues or concerns in those areas would be, I presume, welcome to contact you. And you do have a website, correct?
Yes, it's gregglazer.com.
And that's G-L-A-S-E-R, right? Gregglazer.com. So folks, look him up there, especially if you're out in California. And boy, some interesting things going on in California. My understanding, the governor just enacted AB 499, a bill that allows minors as young as 12 to consent to HPV vaccines. And I learned just this morning, unconfirmed on my part at this point, that some 30 states in the country have similar laws. I was only specifically aware of California and North Carolina just because I hadn't gotten around to trying to search other state statutes to see what's going on out there. Very disturbing thing. We'll come back to that. But today we want to talk about a 1905 Supreme Court case. And before you say, what the heck does that have to do with anything today, we're talking about Jacobson v. Massachusetts, a case that was about vaccines and about the existence or lack of existence or perhaps boundaries of constitutional right to refuse vaccines under a state law that mandated them, and how Jacobson has been interpreted over the years since, because I think, and Greg, by all means, clarify or correct me here, but I think it would be fair to say, at least generally, that the Jacobson case is kind of the foundation for our current vaccine policy and law. And I'm interested in of course, anything that you want to explore or tell us about this, Greg, but in how this case has been interpreted over the years and perhaps cited in other U.S. Supreme Court or other cases. And what does this tell us about what policy, vaccine policy is, and perhaps where it's going, if there's any anything implied by the way the courts have looked at it? So that's my sort of sense of today's overview. And Greg, please chime in here and clarify or correct any of that in terms of what you'd like to cover today.
Sure, yes. I'd be happy to jump in here. So the Jacobson versus Massachusetts Supreme Court case is a seminal case because it was decided in 1905 during a time of smallpox epidemic, and many of the states in the Northeast were passing these laws about vaccination, requiring vaccination, and if you didn't get the vaccination, then you had to pay a fine. And so there was this preacher and his son in Massachusetts who challenged a local ordinance. And they said, this is unconstitutional. You can't make me get a vaccine. And so they challenged it under the Due Process Clause. And now due process is that's your standard Fifth Amendment right to be free from, there's a privacy right in it. It's a freedom of bodily integrity and personal security, security in your property, free from unreasonable search and seizure. And so the preacher and his son challenged this law. And the court issued this opinion, which is, it's a very long opinion, and it talks in very lofty language about the rights that a person has and balancing those personal rights that you have to your body with the rights of the state to regulate public health and safety. And so the court, in the process of this long discussion, makes so many statements that have been quoted throughout the years by the United States Supreme Court in later cases, and also by state courts, state Supreme Courts and lower courts as well. So Jacobson has come out as the case that defines what is the boundaries of forced vaccination. And so there are two main scholarly camps that have come out interpreting Jacobson. One is like Professor George Annis and Wendy Mariner, who come out and say, well, Jacobson must be limited in its holding, and here's some cases that have limited its holding, and here's how to properly interpret Jacobson. It doesn't really require forced vaccination as long as you meet your exemptions and so forth. So that's one camp. The more reasoned camp, in my opinion. And then the second camp is paid by the military. And they are paid by the military. And that is like your Lawrence Gostin, David Fidler. So it's these guys who work for work in D.C., around D.C., and they receive their funding from these from a university that's not really it's like a cover for military operations. And they also publish articles and talk about and even write proposed model emergency laws, like the State Emergency Act. And their interpretation of Jacobson is that it allows for forced vaccination, but the state will provide limited exception, which means like military tribunals. So essentially the state will be able to do whatever it wants. And so these two camps are, at odds in a sense. And so what we could do today is dig in a little bit and try to understand this case of Jacobson for ourselves. And in the big picture, Jacobson is about freedom. It's about the supremacy of the individual will or supremacy of your right to choose and versus the state's right to protect or the state's obligation, responsibility, however you want to put it, state's responsibility to the public to promote public health and public safety and what those terms mean. And so, as I've said in a previous show, the Jacobson case to me reads like two different opinions. It seems like half of the opinion is written by a guy in a black robe and a white wig, and the other half is written by my grandpa holding a cup of scotch. If one is very protective of liberty and rights, and the other is very institutionalized. For example, we'll find statements in Jacobson where Judge Harlan, who's the Supreme Court judge who wrote the opinion, where he's talking about how it's okay to have a mandatory draft for the military, that this is your duty as a citizen and so forth. And then another part of it is talking about the sovereign and independent will of the individual to, you know, reject any law of the state that trumps his natural right. And so, you know, again, I mean, the natural right stuff is my grandpa with the scotch, and the, you know, the mandatory war, you know, draft is the black robe and the wig. And so lawyers who are advocating a particular position or scholars advocating a particular position will just take quotes from this Jacobson case and then use them to their advantage or to support their position. So it's quite natural that we'll find you can use the Jacobson case to say what you want to say. And the modern military-industrial complex is using it to advocate forced vaccination with limited exception only through military tribunals and quarantine and so forth in the event of like a bioterrorist attack and in the event of a declared emergency. So that is the big picture overview of the Jacobson case. And the topic that we're going to launch into next, I think, is how Jacobson has been interpreted by other courts. So we're going to be talking about subsequent decisions of Jacobson, where, you know, where a court later on they have a similar question will come up, and they will rely on the Jacobson opinion. They'll cite to it, they'll refer to it when writing a new opinion, and that tells us how the case has evolved over time and what it means today. I think. Bottom line, people just want to know, you know, does Jacobson protect me? You know, does Jacobson protect my rights to individual freedom? And the answer is, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I didn't mean to cut you off there. Go ahead and give your answer, and then let me chime in, please.
Yeah. The answer to that question of whether Jacobson protects your rights is it depends on who is interpreting Jacobson.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to – I really want to dig in to see what has happened with Jacobson since 1905, but if I could just a couple of real brief, hopefully brief questions that I'd like to ask just for a little bit further clarification, that it seemed to me as I'm reading Jacobson that one of the issues there is what is the reach of the state's police power, and I wondered if you would – I know we've talked about this extensively in the past, but if you would just for – today's show purposes, give us just a brief explanation of what police power is, and is this case, or to what extent do you see this case, and maybe the answer is, you've already given it, is just how do you interpret it, but at least in one sense, the case seems to be looking for the balance of the individual rights versus the state, because, for example, there's a lot of language in there about how individual rights are not unbounded and they have to be curtailed when the greater good of the community is concerned and so forth. But doesn't all of this kind of sit on top of this idea of the state's police power? So if you could just real briefly give us some information about what that is or means.
Sure. Yeah. The police power is, according to the Supreme Court, it's not susceptible of definition with circumstantial precision, but it relates to the governmental power of self-protection, and so it permits reasonable regulation of rights to protect the community from injury. And so this has been interpreted as providing for law and order, public health, public safety. And it stems from the traditional police powers from Rome and from England that the community used to have, just the right of self-defense and like tribal government, and then it evolved over time into this idea of a police force and, you know, the king's power. And so that's why the Supreme Court today says it's not really susceptible to like any careful definition. It's just this sort of amorphous concept of what the police has the power to do.
Sort of this generalized right of the state to take reasonable measures to protect itself, so long as it doesn't cross constitutional boundaries, I guess. Would that be generalized way of saying that then?
Sure. Yeah. So the police power is, it's a necessary power, but it also will come into conflict with the right of individuals in many instances. You know, your general freedom to do what you want without hurting others will occasionally butt into the police power, depending on how someone views the police function. And in the modern state, you know, where the government is providing so much regulation, it's more common to find all these intrusions into the police power. All these intrusions of the police power into individual rights. And so the one that we're talking about with Jacobson is the right of personal freedom, personal liberty, bodily integrity, compared to the police power to regulate the public health. And so public health regulations have their origin in the old quarantine of ships back in Europe, and they came over to the States even before the United States was a country, and it was always assumed and upheld that local governments had the right to issue quarantine regulations to protect the citizenry. And so the modern cases today also recognize that common law basis and that fundamental that traditional basis of state power to provide for public health measures. And so you'll have like your local board of health that will issue their own orders for public health protection. And that was what was at issue in the Jacobson case. And so now we also have, major federal departments of health as well, like the CDC, that issue their own regulations. And so and we've talked about that in other shows, but today we'll just be focusing on Jacobson primarily.
And it seemed to me one of what seemed to me sort of the disturbing things that I read in the Jacobson opinion in terms of its implications is that the court said that the courts and the legislature both can take commonly assumed, things that are common knowledge, whether they're ultimately correct or not, that the courts can and legislatures both can just sort of take those things as fact. Jacobson was not even allowed at trial to present his evidence to try and prove problems with vaccines. And it seemed to me that what the court was saying there is that this is a law that the state legislature is presumed to have considered these opposing theories about vaccines, and they decided what was right and best for the people. And so we as individuals can't really go back and challenge that in court. We can't ask the court to find that the legislature got it wrong. And there is arguably then a legislative presumption is the phrase that I have been using myself about this when it comes up in my practice, that vaccines are legally at least generally safe and effective, that there's a legislative presumption once the legislature mandates vaccines, that there's a legal presumption that they are safe and effective, and that if we disagree with that, the courts can't help us. We got to go back to the state legislature and say, you guys got this wrong and change the law from that angle or point. Does that seem consistent with your read on it as well?
A very useful sort of broad overview. I'm going to throw some caveats in there, though, that the Jacobson Court, the trial court in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that heard the Jacobson case, even before 1905, before it got to the Supreme Court, they did actually allow evidence to be heard regarding the effectiveness of the vaccines. But what the court found was that, and the Supreme Court noted this in their opinion, was that there was nothing in the record that was sufficient to justify the petitioner, Hennig, the preacher's argument that he could trump the legislative will. And so they still kept open the possibility that someone could come along down the road and challenge it with more sufficient evidence. So they actually did qualify their holding in that way. So, like, here I'll even quote right here. It says, "We are not inclined to hold that the statute establishes the absolute rule that an adult must be vaccinated if it be apparent or can be shown with reasonable certainty that he is not at the time a fit subject to vaccination, or that vaccination, by reason of his then condition, would seriously impair his health or probably cause his death." And so that was just one example where the court was saying that, you know, if you're a plaintiff and you can make a case that this vaccine is going to hurt you, you know, like present maybe a doctor's certificate or something like that, then the state can certainly give you an exemption, or you can establish your exemption even if the state doesn't. And so,
yeah, as to him as an individual, but the court did not allow him to present his evidence against vaccination in the general sense.
To do that because the court's power, I mean, going all the way back to Marbury versus Madison, they have a duty to analyze the legality of the law under the Constitution. And so the court recognized that even though they applied the wrong test, they applied the rational basis test, which basically says that as long as there's a rational basis, as long as the legislature finds some rational basis for the law, then the courts will not step in with their own judgments and overturn the law. Now, you might be able to later courts have changed this test, the rational basis test. And I only found one exception with Justice Rehnquist in one case. I think it was in the 80s. Although I'm sure there's more. That's just what I found in this medical arena. Okay, so going back, the rational basis test says that, and it's this old test. It says that the legislature is not going, I mean, the courts aren't going to undo a law as long as there's a rational basis for it. But then later on, when we get to the 1950s and 60s, really between 1953 and 1969, the constitutional doctrine for public health matters changed. They used a different test. Now, the test isn't whether the law is just rational. They'll look at whether a fundamental right is involved. And here, a fundamental right is involved. You have your right to bodily integrity, your right to freedom of religion. You know, I mean, your religion may say that it's, you don't want, like, diseased calf lymph nodes inserted by needle into your neck. You know, and that's pretty reasonable, right? And so if you have a fundamental liberty right to that you can establish in court, then the court would say, oh, okay, well, because you have this strong right, we're going to make sure that the law that is hurting your right isn't just rational, but that there is a compelling reason for this law. And that's, you know, so the difference between what is some rational reason and a compelling reason, there's a big gap there. There's a big difference. So it's much higher, much harder to show a compelling reason. And then the courts will also go one step further and say, not only does the state's reason for this law have to be compelling, but the law itself must be written very narrowly so that it doesn't overreach into your rights. And so if you apply this test, if this new heightened, it's called heightened scrutiny, if you apply this heightened scrutiny test to the case of forced vaccination, wow, you know, a plaintiff, you know, a class of plaintiffs, people who are asserting their natural rights might actually be able to win the case and win using even under Jacobson, even without overturning this Jacobson case. And so it's just a matter of what test is going to be applied would determine probably what the outcome of the case would be. Because again, you're going to find a lot of different opinions in society. Obviously, the government and major medical institutions, the medical establishment, is promoting this idea that vaccines are safe and everything is as it should be. Please go back to watching your American Idol and eating your potato chips type of mentality. But for people who are recognizing what's really going on in the world, there's this whole other camp, this open eyes camp, which is saying, no, look, not all is what it seems. These things are harmful. There's this massive medical lobby that seems to have taken over the regulatory powers. And even this view was found in a case. It's what is this one case? It's a North Dakota case. It's a concurring opinion, and it's a there was a judge who said that. Let me just pull this quote for you guys. Here it is. Okay, this is a short quote. I'm going to read to you. And this is a judge from North Dakota. Of course, a different story than the story about vaccine risks is told by the class that reap a golden harvest from vaccination and the diseases caused by it. Yet because of their self-interest, their doctrine must be received with the greatest care and scrutiny. Every person of common sense and observation must know that it is not the welfare of the children that causes the vaccinators to preach their doctrines and to incur the expense of lobbying for vaccination statutes. And if anyone says to the contrary, he either does not know the facts or he has no regard for the truth. So, that's obviously a very strong statement from, and this judge also said that the responsibility of the courts is to protect civil liberties from abuses of state power. And he warned against judges, quote, too ready to follow the example of Pontius Pilate, to wash their hands and to blame a supposed law or a precedent for their unjust decisions, close quote. So as you can see, this issue of vaccination definitely can bring out the passion of people, because it touches upon some of our most cherished traditions and also some of our deepest fears. This idea that the state can just come along and stick a needle into you or into your children, and your only recourse is to, generally that you wouldn't have any recourse. And so judges have recognized this, I just pointed to a North Dakota 1919 concurring opinion. I mean, that's so obscure, it's so hard to find, and again, when you're looking through the cases, you may have a difficulty finding cases that are challenging Jacobson or limiting the opinion or interpreting it correctly, finding my grandpa drinking scotch in the opinion rather than finding the white hair, black robe. So I'm going to turn it back to Alan right now to gather your thoughts on that, Alan.
Well, that is wonderful to hear that there's somebody out there at all in the judiciary taking what I would consider, and I gather you as well, a more objective and reasoned position to it, when you've got Jacobson kind of making this sweeping, almost doesn't matter what the truth is, as long as everybody believe, most people believe it, we can take it as true kind of mentality. Of course, at that time, we didn't have mass media at all in the way we do now, but if that sort of, if that were something that were considered to be valid and true today legally, that what the prevailing mainstream beliefs are, or what the prevailing beliefs of the medical community are, is something that courts and legislatures can take as fact. It's very disturbing for today, because that certainly implies that whoever controls the media controls the law almost by default. And of course, as is obvious by anyone who notes the high percentage of commercials that are for pharmaceutical products these days, clearly, if even by no other means, as primary sponsors of many shows on TV today, the pharmaceutical industry does control the media to a very large extent. So these kind of things, ideas are kind of disturbing. What else have you found in the legal precedent in terms of anyone talking about Jacobson, either affirming it or expanding it? Because let me chime in with a quick idea, and I'd be curious to know if you've encountered this anywhere. Because one of the things that people have tried to do, in fact, an attorney tried to do this in a case earlier this year in the Fourth Circuit, is to look at Jacobson as a case that was dealing with the mandatory vaccination in the context of a local epidemic, local outbreaks. And that's a very different thing, at least as a starting point, from vaccination when there are no imminent threats, no local outbreaks, and you're talking about just a more sort of hypothetical future risk of disease that ultimately may or may not even happen or you know, is in any event is not imminent. And yet it seems like in Workman v. Mingo with the Fourth Circuit earlier this year that the court was saying, and I think either saying or implying at least, that this has been, I believe it said, if I remember correctly, that they said Jacobson had previously already been expanded to apply to non-emergency situations. Do you have any understandings or thoughts about that?
It was immediately following Jacobson. The interpretations of the state courts were that the case only applied if there was an imminent threat. You know, because again, Jacobson was the, you know, there was this epidemic in the Northeast that was declared about smallpox. So cases interpreted it that way. But then things changed when you got to in 1923, there was a Texas court decision which disallowed the, there was a child who had been, he had a homeopathic certificate from a homeopathic doctor, and the court disallowed that vaccine exemption and said that, you know, we're not gonna accept this. And they didn't care that about the necessity of the, you know, even though this child was totally healthy, you know, they didn't care about whether it was necessary or not. And then after the and then in 1934 Texas case, they wouldn't evaluate whether an emergency even existed. They just said, we cannot attempt to measure how pressing a necessity must be in order to allow the board's discretion to be exercised. So, you know, so again, they're going right back to the legislature, the Board of Health, which is, you know, your local government. They're saying your local government will make the decisions, you know, and courts are not going to step in and assess, you know, whether it's a good decision or a bad decision, whether an emergency exists or it doesn't exist. We're just going to enforce the law.
Now, these folks are the experts, our local departments of health and state departments of health. What problems, if any, do you see with us as a society just sort of deferring that decision to those experts as opposed to there being a more kind of statutory or constitutionally drawn line about where they can or can't go? Because
yeah,
it seems to me from what you're saying is that they've been given the authority to decide something that might have been ruled as a constitutional boundary or other legal boundary.
Yeah. I mean, I think the danger is that we will further lessen the extent of the republic that we have here in America. You know, a republic is based on individual rights and balance with the democracy. If you just have straight majority rule, then what you have is
mob rule,
playbook for an oppressive regime. And an oppressive regime becomes more oppressive in times of emergency. You know, you find this in especially in Germany or North Korea. And so the and emergencies are more likely to exist when you have a time of turmoil, you know, and that's a major danger. So right now, this year, 2011, puts us in, it's a turning point in time, you might say. This whole decade has just been a turning point. And so, because the world is in turmoil, you know.
And we may be economically, if not also otherwise, are if I hear what you're saying correctly, we're perhaps more susceptible to some abuse of rights just because the times are more tension-filled, stressful, and hectic in general. Am I reading you right on that?
Oh, yeah. You definitely are. And in some instances where you had a major deference to the establishment, like in the 1950s in America, you find cases interpreting Jacobson that went very far with the case. I mean, shockingly far. Like, I can point to an Arkansas case where they, again, they didn't look into the validity of the whether there was an emergency or not. And in the 1960s, this is again Arkansas, a court used evidence of the one parent's refusal to vaccinate their child to remove the child from the father's custody and place them with the guardian and order them to be forcefully vaccinated. Now, after the vaccination, the court did order that after the vaccination, the children would be returned to the dad. But, you know, I suppose that's some consolation. But all the same, I mean, that's so oppressive. You know, that's just totally – and there was no emergency here. It's just like because you were even in front of the court, you know, the court's going to make all these decisions for you. That is such an extreme reading of the Jacobson case. That is a court reading into something what they want to read into it and not looking at the safeguard. I mean, I can point to so many safeguards in Jacobson that should prevent against this type of abuse by the judicial system, and you see it a lot in the family courts. But, yeah, I mean, that would be, you know, one example. And you know, Jacobson, you know, again, there's something so much bigger and so much that is behind the scenes here. You know, one of the safeguards of Jacobson was this idea, you know, I'll quote the case, a sphere within which the individual may assert the supremacy of his own will and rightfully dispute the authority of any human government, especially of any free government existing under a written constitution to interfere with the exercise of that will. So, I mean, this is it's about this battle between the government and the individual. And so Jacobson is this seminal case, not just for forced vaccination, but for the idea of liberty itself and where government comes from. You know, what is the authority? And, even the name, you know, Jacobson also makes me think in terms of its meaning as well. Who were the sons of Jacob? I'll give that one to Debbie.
she may not be with us right at the moment here, but okay. that is so... I was just going to say, so disturbing to hear courts overstepping their power that way, and we had it even in recent history with Maryland a couple of years ago when parents were threatened by the courts and with prosecution if they didn't get their kids vaccinated. And presumably all under the belief that vaccines are reasonably safe, effective, and necessary, and by not vaccinating you're being negligent in your parenting of your children and negligent in that you're creating an unnecessary risk for the community and so forth. Of course, the fundamental issue, a problem with those beliefs is that there is an overwhelming body of evidence that directly contradicts that, and that we have then this, what underlies current policy and law, in my opinion, is this completely inappropriate marriage of industry and government, where the industry basically has profound influence within and over government and therefore over federal recommendations and basically controlling for its own self-interest policy and law and with the suppression of information contrary to that agenda. And so the issues that we've been talking about so far have to do sort of like with the question of where are the lines of personal autonomy? Where should you be able to say no to your government with regard to your own body and where and under what circumstances? But I guess I would say that issue can rightfully be enlarged to include questions about where does the information that informs policy and law come from, and is that valid? And of course, my assertion is that it's profoundly tainted historically and up to the present. Any thoughts about how that ties in then, or comments to the more narrow question of bodily integrity?
Yeah. The most prominent bodily integrity cases from the Supreme Court, and this is a good segue into this, you know, Supreme Court cases of Jacobson is Cruzan, and this is a 1990 case. It upholds the right to refuse medical treatment. And so, you know, the court cites Jacobson in the case, and they cite it for, here's the principle that a competent person has a constitutionally protected liberty interest in refusing unwanted medical treatment may be inferred from our prior decisions. And then they right there, they cite Jacobson. And so, and many cases will, here's Planned Parenthood versus Casey, an abortion case. Jacobson cited for a state's interest in the protection of life falls short of justifying any plenary override of individual liberty claims. So it's this idea that, you know, the state is limited. You know, they're not, it's not this all-encompassing power, and that's what Jacobson really holds. And my memo, which you referenced earlier, Alan, which is available at pandemicresponseproject.com, it goes into detail on Jacobson, and there's actually another memo that I would love to direct any listeners the attention to. It's called Reconsidering Compulsory Childhood Vaccination by Mary Holland, and that one as well is very useful in analyzing Jacobson, the scope of it and how it's been interpreted over time. But one of the ones that I think we should really dive into today is the case of Yoder. Do you know that one?
I'm not familiar with that. Please acquaint me with it.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So Yoder is this case where the some Amish. It's called Wisconsin versus Yoder, 1972. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Go for it.
Yeah. So the Amish were they didn't want their kids to go to high school. They wanted their kids to go to be homeschooled primarily, and that upon reaching the age where they would go to high school, they just wanted to, you know, continue doing the homeschool approach. And so the state of Wisconsin filed a suit, or they made charges against this parent, this dad, and they said that he was they fined him, but it was under threat of criminal prosecution. And so they fined him $5, interestingly. That was the same amount in the Jacobson case. And so the court rejected the state's position. It was sort of one of those, like, give a little, take a little. You know, it's a case where if you read it right, then there, you know, it protects liberty, but if you read it wrong, you might misinterpret it. But the court rejected this the state's claim of parens patriae, which is this old Latin phrase that means that the state becomes the ward of a subject if there's no one else to provide for him. So, like, if, you know, like a guardianship. And so the court rejected the state of Wisconsin's overbroad claim of that doctrine, and they found that the Amish parent was able to assert an exemption to the state. He was able to assert an exemption to the state's mandatory high school requirement. And so the court goes into great detail and mentions Jacobson, and they go into great detail on the basis for this law and what is the First Amendment right of the Amish parent to guard his religious practices, you know, and how that's held into balance. And so they didn't just look to see whether there was a rational basis for this law. They applied the heightened scrutiny, and they said, you know what, even though there is a basis, even though the state does have a basis in educational interest in ensuring that, you know, kids are going to school and that there's not going to be like a child labor violation and things like that. So even though the state has these interests, and it's not going to apply to this particular Amish group, because these particular Amish group, they are, you know, these kids are, they're being educated in skills and trades, and These aren't like fallout children, you know, and they consistently produce strong citizens. And so the court, you know, has, again, this long opinion with this very lofty language, which discusses the meaning of not just Jacobson, but the meaning of what the state's police power is and how far it can go. And so the state, you know, they advance the argument that, you know, they have this compulsory education interest, and they reference, you know, Thomas Jefferson and saying that it's so important to prepare citizens to participate effectively in the political system, and that they didn't want these kids being left out. And so, and you've done some work on Yoder, right, Alan?
I certainly have referenced it in some of my work and cases in the past. It's a case that does support, I think, to a strong degree, rights in the vaccine exemption and waiver arena in certain circumstances. I want to just take a second here. We're actually, boy, this has been terrific. We're actually down to our last maybe 5 to 8 minutes or so. We have to finish up just a little bit early today, so the next show can come in on time. And we do have a caller on the line. Is this a good time for you, Greg, to me to see if we have a question there, maybe from a caller for you?
Of course.
Okay, caller, number ending in 5-4, are you with us? We had a technical problem previously, Greg, where we had somebody on the line who later emailed me and said they weren't even trying to get in.
Hello?
So,
hello?
Yes, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can, yes. Do you have a question for Greg or us today?
Yes, I do. I think you know me. My name is Jamie, and I'm calling from Massachusetts.
Jamie, a great pleasure to have you. Jamie, by the way, folks, is an author, years spent researching and providing by way of a book or books terrific information to help inform and educate people about vaccine issues. Pleasure to have you on with us today, Jamie.
Yes. Well, I'll send this question out to both you guys, and I'd just like to get some insight from you about it. I'm familiar with the Jacobson case. I've read it a couple of times over the years, and I also read the case that preceded it at the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts, and I believe that was Commonwealth versus Jacobson. The thing that struck me about police power, and you were focusing on that before, it puts restrictions on citizens' liberty for the general benefit, we'll say, welfare and safety of all the citizens. And yet, in Massachusetts, and it's still a statute in Massachusetts, even in 1905, Henning Jacobson had the choice of paying a $5 fine rather than being vaccinated, and I assume that he elected out of his principles, which were very high, and because he had been injured with the smallpox vaccine previously in his life, as did his son. He elected not to pay that $5 fine. Now, I assume that $5 in 1905 was probably, I don't know what it's worth today, but I bet it was $500. I'm not sure, though. But I'm sure for some working men that was a lot of money to do that. But the thing, apparently, immunization was not compulsory in Massachusetts for all people in 1905, and yet they gave the citizens a way out. And I'm just wondering, that was never really discussed in the case at all. And it almost seems like, well, what happens if like 3,000 people in Massachusetts decided to pay the fine? How does that impact public health? If those people are unvaccinated, don't they present a problem to the health and welfare of the other citizens? They're going to become a locus of infection. So it's so contradictory, and that a person could just say no to this, and yet other people can say no if they pay some money, and it's not regarded as completely forgotten the fact that they may be a risk to the public health. I'd love a comment or two about that from either of you, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you, sure. Jamie, and I'm going to let you feel that one, Greg.
Yeah, yeah, and he's right. Yeah, from the case, it's from 1903. There was the lower court's opinion, well, the Supreme Court's opinion in Massachusetts, Commonwealth versus Jacobson, and they said, if a person should deem it important that vaccination should not be performed in his case, and the authority should think otherwise, it is not in their power to vaccinate him by force, and the worst that could happen to him under the statute would be the payment of $5. And so, yeah, yeah, the gentleman's absolutely right. The preacher could have left the jurisdiction, and the Supreme Court of Massachusetts found that very important because of this idea that if there wasn't that out, if there wasn't that exemption, that way to get away out of the law, then it would be a form of absolute power over the individual within that jurisdiction. I mean, you could imagine there was this uniform mandatory vaccination rule and you couldn't get out of it unless you had to leave the United States. That'd be a form of absolute power within the United States. Even worse if it was a UN rule.
Well, I think under current vaccine policies, we see, as far as I know, there's never been a case testing whether or not there's a situation that the state could lawfully physically force the vaccine. And what we see, for the most part, as I see it anyway, in policy currently, is that the state can require vaccines, even throw exemptions out the window in a declared emergency. But I think the farthest they could legitimately go for people who refuse, even if there isn't a valid exemption option available, would be to quarantine them. And it seems to me, even under mainstream vaccine views, that that quarantine would be the compromise between an perfectly viable and reasonable compromise, again, under mainstream vaccine and infectious disease views, between the state's need to protect the citizens and the individual's right to personal autonomy. You have a thought about that as well, Greg, in our last couple of minutes here?
Yeah, the quarantine has been the proposed remedy by both camps that I was discussing earlier, both by the Gostin camp and by the Mariner camp. And so, the scope of protections within quarantine, that's another debate. And then, whether you can self-quarantine, that's another debate.
Well, maybe we'll come back in the future and explore that a little bit further, because that would be a great topic. Because I think the biggest risk for U.S. citizens right now is that there's another pandemic or epidemic, whether natural or otherwise, but when as you know, because we've discussed this at length, and I hope we continue to do so, that once the state declares an emergency, the rights can shift, perhaps radically. In many states, exemptions do go out the window. And so there are some very serious questions raised, because those of us who are concerned about routine immunizations are usually even more concerned about emergency vaccines. They're made called fast track. They're made more quickly. They have little or no testing compared to the routine immunizations. There's even more to be afraid of, frankly, with an emergency vaccine. And yet the rights seem to diminish rather than increase because of that uncertainty. And so I see that as there certainly are many fronts where there are concerns about rights, but I see that as a main one. We do need to go ahead and wrap up here, but Greg, I want to give you an opportunity to make any additional comments there about any of the above, and great pleasure as always having you here. I look forward to having you again in the near future.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, to answer the gentleman's the second part of the gentleman's question about the what happens if you have a high number of people using their exemptions. And there actually is an example of a town that did that, and it's Ashland, Oregon, and they have one of the highest exemption rates. And so the response of the medical establishment has been to find those towns and criticize them, but no legal recourse. And so as it turns out, it may be an effective strategy for a holistic resolution to this vaccination problem. And thank you having me on the show.
Oh, pleasure as always. It's Greg Glaser, attorney Greg Glaser, Glaser, GregGlaser.com from California. Homeopathy World Community is the sponsor for this show. And we thank Debbie Bruck for that, founder of Homeopathy World Community. You can find links to my ebook, The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, on the Homeopathy World Community .com website. And then my website is www.vaccinerights.com and pandemicresponseproject.com. We want to thank all our listeners today. We're here every Thursday with Vaccines in Your Rights, and Attorney Glaser here ordinarily the first Thursday of the month. So please tune in next week and in coming weeks, and we'll look forward to having you all hopefully back with us again. And Greg, thanks again, and thanks to Jamie for calling in. We'll see if we can get him back in here as well.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Bruck on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Like you're in.